Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hey.
Hi.
How are you? We are in a slap happy mood. It is very late. We have the lights very low.
Yeah, it's 8 o'clock. Allie's husband decided he was going to put on trap music and turn all the lights red. So we finally got the music off. But yep. It is kind of bumping in here. It's a whole vibe.
I was like, get out. We're recording. And then he just starts messing with me. So,
so
jokes
quick.
On him. I love it.
I know. It is good. And I was just saying, like, I personally love it. I don't have any kids at home. So, like, it's so nice to get, you know, just some joy back in the day.
Yeah, we all had dinner together, a little fam we dinner, did. Me, him, and you.
Yeah, I love having dinner with mom and dad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. But we don't have, like, a super ton to talk about in our life. But
yeah, because true crime news.
Yes, I've heard there's some other things to talk about today.
Yes. So Abby has like unaware of all of this. So I just figured I'd bring it up. Casey Anthony is on fucking TikTok now.
The fuck?
What
is she doing? Like lip syncs to like her trial?
No, worse. She has this video and she's like sitting in her car and she's like, you know me, Casey Anthony. Kaylee Anthony's mom, and we're like, no one forgot, bitch. We were there. We recall.
Casey Anthony giveth and Casey Anthony taketh away.
She did, though. And it's just, it's very funny to listen to her because she's like, I'm coming back, you know, into the world or whatever of like social media and everything, because she's been off of like everything. Like, there's been sightings of her.
Mm-hmm.
Like out living her life, because obviously she's free and doing whatever it is that she likes to do.
Yeah.
But she said that now she has turned a new leaf and she's actually been working in the legal field since 2011, and she's going to be doing advocacy work.
She's been what?
Yes. And I'm like, ma'am, your trial doesn't count.
Hold up. What advocacy work?
I believe it's for the LGBTQ community advocacy, but I think like in general, like victims of violence. And I was just like, but weren't you the violence?
Girl, get my name out your mouth. I don't want you here.
Abby said it here. The gays don't claim her.
No.
You heard it here, right? So jot that down.
So, you know, I want you to, what's that? Jotting? Good. Jot it.
So that is completely wild to me.
No, you're right. So she's been in the legal field since 2011?
She says she's been in the legal field since 2011.
Did she specify what role in that whole process?
I believe part of it was as a defendant. But that's just, if my memory serves me right, a couple years ago, I think it was 2023 or 2022, that whole documentary on her came out.
Yeah.
I never watched it because I didn't want to give her a dime. But my guess, if I were a betting woman,
mm-hmm.
would be that the money from that dried up and now she's starting her next thing. I think it would have been
something new and lucrative.
Yes, it would have been too much. Like, she had to kind of spread out her earnings. You know what I'm saying?
You know what I think, though, personally and truly,
mm-hmm.
genuinely, in my deepest heart of hearts, I think her and Jodi Arias should hook up at some point. Not like that, but just I think they could mutually try to scam a lot of people. I think it'd be great.
I bet they'd discover they have more in common than they think.
Jodi could have a t-shirt that says Survivor, and mm-hmm. Casey Anthony could say I support survivors.
It's just awful.
I advocate for you to survive, babe.
I don't know, because in the like shred of possibilities that she's innocent, and you know, frankly, we know my thoughts on this, but if she is, then how awful for her to be alienated and vilified the way that she has been.
Yeah.
But.
Big but.
Big buts, and I cannot lie, but. I mean, she opened a daycare tomorrow, No, ma'am. Not today, not now, not never.
That's what I always say. Not my daycare, not my problem. I Aye.
So I don't want to pay attention to it. Like, I don't have TikTok or anything, but of course you see everything on TikTok, just everywhere else. So I, of course, saw it. And then, of course, I watched it. And I'm like, I don't want to give her attention. You know what I mean? I don't want to give that. But I hope she can do something productive with all that's left of her life, since she was young when everything happened.
True.
And she's still an objectively very beautiful woman. Like, she just, she is. Yeah. So I'm sure she'll do fine. But it's just the, like, shit of it. Like, really? Isn't that a little on the nose?
Yeah, it's, I think, in a similar vein to, like, if she opened up a daycare tomorrow, would you send your kids there? It's like, if she opened up a victim advocacy agency, would I want her to advocate for me?
No.
I already said get my name out your damn mouth, but that's not the point. The
No, seriously.
And also, like, I mean, listen, if she wanted to be a defense attorney, that's a different story. Babe's got a one-for-one history right now of a winning streak, you know?
Well, she had quite the relationship with Jose Baez.
And not to be biased, you know?
Ooh.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
Well, speaking of another daycare that you wouldn't go to, I don't know if you're familiar with the Lori Vallow, Chad Daybell case, but Lori Vallow apparently just sat for an interview. I've not seen it. I don't know if it's out yet. Maybe by the time this comes out, it will be. But she apparently seems to believe she and Chad will be exonerated.
Oh, cool.
Who's going to tell her?
Should we just send her to the National Registry of Exonerations where she can see all of the crimes that are like decades old that are just finally getting DNA processed? Mm-hmm.
So if you're not familiar with Lori Vallow, or Lori Vallow Daybell, as she is now, and Chad Daybell, they are responsible for the murders of like four people, two of which are Lori's children, in what they were sort of nicknamed the Doomsday Couple, like the Doomsday Killers. They were supposedly doing this for religious reasons, and that, you know, not everybody is real. Some are zombies who need to be like put out. And of course, her own children were, and then they were found buried on the property of her new husband. And it's a terrible case. I watched a documentary on it. I feel like we talked about this a couple years ago.
Yeah, we might have.
Where her, I believe it was her oldest son, was interviewed a lot in this, and he kind of talked about it. And I mean, you feel for him so much. You just want to give him like the biggest hug. It's just to see what happened to his whole, I mean, his whole life changed in a day, and changed in the worst ways it could. So it's just, I keep an eye on that. I don't think they're going anywhere. We all know they're not going anywhere. But I think she's enjoying the attention. So there's a lot in this true crime world right now.
What? And, you know, I mean, Sorry. Just what in the cluster B personality disorder?
Yeah, it's pretty intense. I think we should cover the Doomsday Couple at some point. But I tend to like when cases are resolved.
Yeah.
Mostly. So just that you can give a full comprehensive view of the entire start to finish.
Yeah.
And you don't need a part two that's like a year later. But I'm down to try anything. So we'll see.
But that's a really good segue to today's case, actually.
Oh.
Because today's is very well done and over with. And it was resolved very recently. But it was cold for like 40 years.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Are you ready? We going? Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Yoo-hoo. Pod's on.
Oh.
Oh, hi. Welcome or welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast. About time for true crime.
You guys.
Oh, you didn't have to.
But thanks.
Thank you. Somehow, we blinked and it is March.
I know.
And for some reason, spring and spring cleaning always reminds me of like starting fresh and getting back to our roots.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going back to New England today.
I love it.
We're doing another New England true crime, which is really where the heart is.
I know. You know? We haven't done a New England true crime case in so long, and we've had a lot of listeners requesting them.
So true.
So
here you go.
Ask and you shall receive.
Not only are we going to New England, we're going to New Hampshire.
Okay.
Not the old one, the new one.
Yep.
Today's case is the Portsmouth Beauty School murders. And as always, our sources are linked down below, but just for peace of mind, here are some shout outs. I used Murder, She Told's podcast coverage on the case, which was really thorough. And I also used CBS, NBC, thecityofportsmouth.gov, and like a crap ton more. They're all down below. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's any specific trigger warnings today. Both of these are kind of mysterious, so we don't have a lot of detail that I can get into gore with. Mm-hmm. But, you know, per the usual, there is violence, there is murder, and if it is any sort of a warning, there is just sort of an anticlimactic resolution to everything, but there is a resolution.
All right, so it is solved.
Yes.
Okay.
So with that out of the way, let's hop into it.
Let's do it.
Today, we are hopping into Portsmouth, New Hampshire in the 1980s. Portsmouth is a small coastal city way up there, like basically in Maine. In the 1980s, the city had a population of about 26,000 people. The FM radio on your boombox was probably playing Jessie's Girl by Rick Springfield, Dolly's 9 to 5, or You Make My Dreams by Hall & Oates. And I literally wrote, as I'm writing this, I'm realizing this is a great time for Billboard Top 100. Holy poop.
Seriously. The 80s had, like, 70s and 80s had objectively some of the best music.
So good. There's just something about a synth. A synth made by a man in a brightly colored parachute pant. And you know it was like teal and hot pink and yellow. And so hot in there, probably. I don't think those were breathable fabrics.
They didn't look it.
And if it wasn't them, it was the woman in the leotards and the perms with the little like leg warmers for their workout videos.
Of course.
Uh-huh. And a ton of cocaine, but that is not the point.
We do not condone that.
We don't. Portsmouth was a pretty hopping port town, as you may imagine.
Mm.
Once it was incredibly bustling, and it was like a pretty well-renowned city for ship making, which makes sense. And while I don't believe the 80s were like booming in the ship creating industry, it was still a pretty active downtown with ports where ships came in pretty frequently. And granted, it seems like the majority of New Hampshire is not as busy. It's filled with the White Mountains. There's forest ranges and like a ton of open land. So Portsmouth is really one of the few like cities in the state. Something you might not think about culturally when you think of the 1980s was that, in general, the United States actually had a pretty big spike in crime. And New Hampshire was no different. So even though there were generally small, tight-knit communities, everybody experienced a lot of rise in crime during the 80s. And because I'm a nerd, I did track down the Uniform Crime Report of the UCR for 1985 in Portsmouth.
And
it's really interesting. So the one I found was a few years later. It was in 1985. Our case today is in 1981, but this is a pretty accurate picture.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give you an idea of the violent crime reported, in 1985, New Hampshire primarily experienced aggravated assaults, which came in at about 2/3 of the crime that happened overall. They reported in a few different ways, but one that stuck out to me was that they kind of put it into like per timeline. So one of theirs was that an aggravated assault happened on average every 9.5 hours.
Oh, shit.
While a murder occurred approximately every 17 days.
Hmm.
And now that might sound like a lot, and don't get me wrong, it's more than it should be. One is more than it should be.
Hmm.
But just for a comparison, let's consider Chicago in 1985.
Hmm.
Chicago in 1985 saw a homicide every 28 minutes.
Oh, hell.
So every 17 days, yeah, that's a lot. But comparatively, it wasn't really that bad.
Yes.
There's just not a ton of people. It's not a really high crime rate area. There's also just not a lot of population. I think if Portsmouth saw a homicide every 28 minutes, they'd have nobody left pretty quick.
In the 80s, yeah.
Yeah. So Portsmouth was a cute little coastal town, and sure, it was a little more active in the crime scene than other years, but still pretty standard and still significantly lower than other places. So let's go back to 1981. I want you to picture a beauty salon. Okay. Mm-hmm. See the chairs and their hair dryers lined up, the little things that like pop down on your head, and the women pointing at magazines, like wanting a perm, like the one that Farrah Fawcett has, you know? They got thick ass brows haloing like bright eyeshadow all over their face. And also unrelated, I was going through like a timepiece on salons in 1982 and saw an ad for shampoo for permed hair, and the entire Legally Blonde scene just went through my hair. And wouldn't you know that as a woman who's been getting perms for 15 years that you should never get it wet.
What'd you took a shower, did you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also, yes, you might want to hold your breath because that place is caked in aerosol hairspray.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is. Also, watch your step. It's slippery.
From experience?
Who, me? And this is where we're going to meet Laura Kempton, a 23-year-old going to Portsmouth Beauty School.
Okay.
Laura was a free spirit. She was outgoing and she had a huge personality. And she was not slowing down for anyone.
Mm.
Not only did Laura go to Portsmouth Beauty School, but she was an aspiring model. There is this beautiful picture of her in a big hat, like a very big hat. Laura did not seem to take to the permed hair trends, but she was beautiful. And she actually got to do a lot of modeling for different salons that she was. I mean, I guess she only really worked in one, but she was in a few different ones doing like campaigns for different hair products and such.
Oh, very cool.
That was cool. And she's got these beautiful, big, warm eyes and they match her big personality. I love it. But that wasn't all, because amidst her modeling career and full-time schooling and social life, Laura also worked at a little shop downtown. And from what I understand, it's kind of like a quirky little shop. Like they sold kind of funny souvenirs more than like Portsmouth, New Hampshire, heart.
Yeah, you know, like, more knicky-knack stuff.
Yeah, kind of knicky-knacks, kind of like whatever the 80s version of Spencer's would have been. Mixed with like knickknacks.
Yeah.
So just fun, like quirky fun.
Okay.
Like
a little edgy?
A little bit, but like I think more like hee hee, that's a funny play on words than like Spencer's.
Mm.
Yeah. And I want to make kind of a big deal about this, not like a huge one, but just enough, you know, because while today, 40 years later, we are used to the hustle and the bustle, an idea of a woman who has it all with work and friends and home, Laura was living the life. We can't forget that it was only 1974 that women were allowed to open their own bank accounts, which means this was less than 10 years after that. Laura was nearly an adult before that was allowed to happen, and so she probably changed her entire idea of what she wanted to do and what she even could do.
Hmm.
Pretty early on. So she's 23, she's going to school, but she's going to school. She's got an aspiring career. She's going to school for a backup safe career. And then she's also working on her own, which is something that she probably would have never been able to do without being married less than 10 years earlier than that.
Yeah, it's true.
So I just want to make that known because it's just a beautiful little slice of a woman's right movement, you know? But Laura obviously existed outside of that. She is not just a slice of the women's rights movement. She loved to go out to the bars with friends and was hot on the dating scene. I mean, she's beautiful. I get it. Who would not want to date a semi-professional model who's pictured on advertisements in a hair salon where she worked? That's a go-getter.
That's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool. Very glamorous. So on Saturday night, September 26th of 1981... Laura was out for a night on the town. She met her date for the night, Jeremy.
Ooh.
And they danced all night until the place closed down. They literally shut down the bar they were dancing at. And they went back to her apartment, 20 Chapel Street, at about like 1:30 a.m., which is late, queen. But they then decide to go back out for food.
Ma'am.
And then they come back at like 3 a.m.
Girl, and I could never. That's so past my bedtime.
I know. I will say, Laura was one of us. So naturally, she always made sure the door was locked. And she even, like, Jeremy has even been like, yeah, she made me go check it. Like, I had to go make sure the door was locked. And I'm like, good.
Who amongst us have not done that? Come on.
She should. when I used to live with one of my very best friends, we both always did like a safety check before bed. So one of us would always check the door and the oven. And mm-hmm. if one of us did it, we'd like go back and be like, door's locked, oven's off. Like,
because you have to.
You have to.
It's girls looking out for girls.
Just girls being girls. But I will say, Laura typically lived alone. So she was on her own when she wasn't having her suitors over. Mm-hmm. You know.
And you said she's 23?
Yes.
Okay.
And I will say that she did have to get up and work in the morning. And I literally wrote, girl, by 23, I was already too old to be going out till 3 a.m. and have work in the morning.
Seriously.
Like, that's work ethic. I think you should get considered more for a job if you're like, yeah, I was out till 3 a.m. last night and I'm here mm-hmm. with a good attitude.
Seriously.
Now, Laura was able to get up and she actually had breakfast with Jeremy at a local diner before her shift.
Oh my God, did they so even cute. Sleep?
I doubt it. I have no idea.
Wild.
Around 7 p.m., she got out of work and then that night decided to go have dinner with her friend who I believe is named Karen.
Mm-hmm.
But she went out to have dinner and then they were like, okay, we'll have some drinks and we'll listen to the band that's playing. And then they were like, oh, wait, who's that saxophone guy? Oh, it was a guy that Laura was like kind of dating. And so she was like, oh, I kind of hope he'll like hang out after the band. So then they shut down that place that night, listening to the music and drinking and talking. And she was like, hey, Mr. Saxophone Man, do you want to like hang out a little? And he was like, babe, I'm wiped.
Yeah, he's like, no. I'm going home.
He said, I just worked a full shift. I'm working late because I'm a saxophone player.
Mm-hmm.
So Karen and Laura end up trying to go back to Laura's place, just walking home together and all of that. And Laura had invited Karen to stay, but Karen was like, I got to work. I'm sorry. Like, I can't stay over. Mm. And Laura was like, okay, but what about like a cup of coffee really quick? Like just something to wake you up before you go home.
Mm-hmm.
And Karen was like, no, I'm not really feeling up for it. And so she went back.
Okay.
And so Laura traveled home to her Chapel Street apartment that night. A local man named Arthur, who was unhoused and known in the area, often snuck into that apartment building to like sleep. So it seemed like maybe the building door was unlocked, but there were a bunch of apartments in it. So he'd kind of like sneak in and then find like a little nook or cranny by like one of the stairwells.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like he maybe got a little bit drunky and he wanted to find a little spot to sleep. So he came over and he saw a woman and a man arguing on the sidewalk.
Hmm.
And he went, I'm not getting involved with that. He went and found another place to sleep.
Yep.
And then he woke up a little bit later and the arguing was done. And he said, okay, I'm going back to my spot. And he went to like sneak into the building. And as he went up to like the third floor, there was like a little nook he found. He heard a bunch of arguing and crashing noises.
Oh, okay.
But he said, listen, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm not saying shit about shit. I'm going to go take a nap.
Right.
And that's what he did. Until a few hours later when he woke up and heard more of that arguing and noticed that some of the hallway lights were out that didn't used to be.
Oh.
And so he was like, okay, shit. Well, if the police are going to come because there's arguing, I'm not going to be here. So he blasts. He gets out of town. Mm-hmm. And by out of town, I mean he goes to the park and right. sleeps there instead. Another tenant, Laura's neighbor named Daniel, lived like across the hallway from her. And he came home late too. He came home around like 2 a.m. I don't know what this part, like what this building is doing. They're all partying all night.
Mm.
But I mean, at least you're not like waking each other up.
Yeah, right.
But he got home at like 2 a.m. and noticed that Laura's door was broken. It looked weird. Like it wasn't smashed, but he could definitely tell that part of the door was missing.
That's a problem.
It was a problem.
It kind of defeats the integrity of the door, right?
Yeah, it kind of defeats the door of the door.
Yeah.
It makes a better window than a door, yep. you know?
And a door shouldn't make a better window than a door, you know what I mean?
No, it really shouldn't. But he couldn't see entirely through it because there was like a piece of metal sort of protecting it. And he heard something, but he was like, you know what? It's none of my business. If there's someone like intruding on her house, I don't want to get caught up in it. So he goes into his own apartment and he checks to make sure that nobody broke in there. And then he goes to bed.
Ugh.
To which I say, damn, Daniel.
It's like either one of them could have made a difference. Just make an anonymous call.
Literally. And then a few hours later, at 6 a.m., a tenant from the second floor was leaving when she noticed that the back door was ajar. And, like, the front door of the building was typically open, but the back door was seemingly locked most of the time. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty weird. And then she also noticed on her way out of the front door that Laura's door was damaged with a missing panel. And weirder yet was there was music playing in the apartment. She was like, it's 6 a.m. What the hell?
Like, yeah, nobody in this building is that cheery. Everyone just went to bed.
Yeah. So she goes to work and a few hours pass. And I do mean only a few hours because around 9:30 a.m., police officer Ron Gravoy came to serve our girl Laura for some unpaid parking tickets. And listen, I get it. I pay for parking. I almost cried once when there was a mix-up with an online payment thing. It's a thing, okay? I pay for my parking. And normally I would say, but officer, she's just a girl. Why, God, why? She's just a girl. Right? But today, on this exception of September 28th, 1981, that summons was the catalyst for the beginning of a decades-long fight for justice. Officer Gravoy came into the building and he also saw the broken door and got worried. He tried to look through the best he could. And from what I understand, there's kind of like a little sheet of metal on the other side. So he could see like maybe an inch worth of a gap.
Okay.
And he could see enough that he was like, I'm worried. And he knocked. Nobody answered. He entered and it was open, which is also concerning. And when he got in there, I think it must have been like a studio because there was sort of like a main room that was Laura's bedroom and also the living room.
I also imagine to be 23, affording anything bigger than that would have been tough.
Insane. Yeah. But he couldn't really see anyone at first. But what he did see was a really weird bundle of blankets and a mattress and a box spring on the floor.
Oh, it's probably not a bundle of blankets.
No, it sure wasn't. Because Laura was covered in blankets, bedding, and then her box spring and mattress were put on top of her.
What?
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, Officer Gravoy calls for backup and people are coming. Like, now it's a scene.
Yep.
But Laura was found nude under all of that with an electrical cord tying her feet together and a phone cord wrapped around her neck and shoulders. And she had severe, severe blunt force trauma to her head.
That's awful.
As the police continued to investigate, there were no viable signs of breaking and entering. All the windows were locked and there was one that was not locked in the basement with like the screen messed up, but it was small and none of the dirt was disturbed by it. So nothing had happened there.
It sounds like the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Right? It seemed like maybe the killer walked right in, except we know how vigilant Laura was. And tons of evidence was collected, including a pillowcase that I believe was around her head. There was a cigarette butt, which Laura didn't smoke, so that was actually an amazing piece of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a glass bottle found by her body. Upon further investigations, they saw the panel in the door wasn't smashed, but actually carefully removed. So there was a piece of black metal, which like it seemed like the bottom part of a mailbox. You know how some old mailboxes would have like a little metal spiral to like hold the newspaper?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was something like that. And it was sort of bent so that they could pry the molding off of the door. And then the wood panel comes off very easily, which leaves only a sheet of metal.
Okay.
Which is something I learned researching this case. I did not know how doors worked, I guess.
But you know that you don't want your door to be like a window.
I do know that.
You can take that to the bank.
And I'll invest in it. So it was really interesting and kind of confusing. And nobody could figure out anyone that would want to hurt Laura. Everybody really liked her. But the autopsy clinician, Dr. Carlson, shared that Laura's death was the result of a severe beating to the head and that she had been sexually assaulted. Luckily, even though it was 1981, they were able to collect and preserve significant amounts of detail and DNA from this.
That's awesome.
Which, can I just say how impressive it is that anybody can collect DNA and use it to figure out crimes, but also that someone could collect DNA in 1981 and be able to like preserve that DNA so it still has integrity and can still be used decades later. That's huge. I don't know. I'm not a scientist, clearly, but that seems crazy to me.
No, we cover so many cases where it was like they just didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know what was important to save at the time.
Yeah.
And then you get into like the 70s and 80s and they started holding on to it with the hopes that someday there would be.
And thank God they did.
But I'm also still in the mindset as a 90s kid that to me the 90s are 10 years ago and the 80s are 20 years ago. So I think, oh, well, 20 years ago. No, this was 45 years ago.
Yeah, I had like a little crash out researching this because I was like, what do you mean that's 40 years ago? And my parents were alive and walking and have like
graduating
memories from this time. Yes. Oh, the passage of time is a hell of a drug. But the autopsy clinician did believe that a heavy bottle like the glass one found beside Laura was responsible for her death.
Mm.
They kept a bunch of stuff, which thank God they did. They took seminal fluid, which is a gross word, from I think some of the bed sheets around. They also did like a thigh scrape kind of DNA evidence collecting test, and then also they kept the cigarette and the bottle.
Now, do they believe that the bottle was there already, like this person killed her, didn't bring anything to the scene?
Well, the person who killed her had to have at least brought the cigarette to the scene because Laura doesn't smoke. They didn't really say much of whether or not they thought the bottle was there ahead of time, but it does seem like perhaps it had some DNA on it from the killer. So they got invited in and had a drink. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. Like the bottle, was that brought there, or was the whatever that cord was around her ankles? Like, I'm just thinking of anything that could have been brought there, or was this a sudden thing where they just used what they saw? So I don't know.
Yeah, my guess, just from what I see, is that it was probably just what they saw there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not the person that did it. So I couldn't answer that fully. And I wish we had more answers, but we'll get to why we don't soon. Detective spoke with Jeremy, her date from Saturday. Ooh. He also remembered Laura putting cash in an envelope on her table before they left. And the police noted that they did not find it. So whoever took Laura's life also took her envelope of cash. It's just kind of adding insult to injury, in my opinion. They thought maybe it was like for bills.
Yeah, that makes sense. Or rent.
Yeah, it's the 80s. They're not zelling anybody money, you know? So that was an interesting thing just to know. But Arthur, the man that was mentioned before who snuck in, was investigated. They asked him about it, and when they were questioning him, he mentioned the man and the woman arguing on the street corner. And they sort of showed him a picture of Laura, and he was like, yeah. Yeah, that was the woman.
Mm-hmm.
And then he also somehow identified the man as someone named John.
Okay.
Listen, it is unclear how Arthur would know John or who John was or why Arthur believed that this man was a man named John.
Okay.
I'm sorry that I'm laughing.
Okay, so it's not John, is it?
It's not John at all. They did find someone named John and they investigated him, but he was cleared so fucking fast. I don't know who John is and I feel bad. But if you are curious more about John specifically, they did release like a full investigative document when this was resolved that lays him out very explicitly, like his full name, but they don't add a lot of details about who he is outside of that.
Okay, but Laura wasn't actually arguing with John.
It does not appear that Laura was arguing with John.
Poor John's like, what the fuck did I do?
No, he's like, Arthur, man.
My guy.
I thought we were friends.
You think you know someone, you know? Sucks.
But the detectives talk with Laura's friends, her neighbors, her family. Laura's dad had to be the one to identify her, which is just fucking awful. It is so bad. But early leads developed, and the police talked more with Laura's neighbor from across the hall, Daniel, since he saw something weird with the broken door, and he heard something weird, and he thought someone was on the other side, and he was concerned enough about a break-in that he checked his own place for it. They were like, why the hell didn't you check her?
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel seems to have gotten a few rounds of questioning that the police were just really unsatisfied with his answers every time.
Mm-hmm.
So they kept calling him in, and he was like, listen, I didn't want to like get involved. I didn't want to mess with that. The police asked him to do a polygraph, but Daniel refused. And so he landed himself on the suspect list. But I think it was more just because he didn't really want to work with them than any particular evidence pointing them to him.
Right. He wasn't cooperative, but it's not like they really thought he was doing anything.
Right. Luckily, though, and by luckily, I mean, it kind of put him in a little bit of a better light with the police department. Daniel had actually gone to change those light bulbs in the hallway because Arthur had mentioned that, like, it got a little bit dark and some of the lights were out that weren't before.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Daniel went to go change them because he was like, I'd like a hallway that has light in it. So he's going to do that, and he notices that the light bulbs aren't out. They're just unscrewed a little so they wouldn't light up.
Okay, so like intentionally done?
Yeah, so they think it must have been done to like cover something or throw people off or make it a little harder to see whoever did it.
He's like, I won't check on my neighbor, but God damn it, I'm going to get up on my ladder and change the...
Yes. Listen, it was 2 a.m. when he had to check on the neighbor, okay? This is a few days later. He's rested, baby.
Maintenance crews got nothing on Daniel.
No. The devil works hard, but Daniel works harder, you know? So he calls the police. He's like, hey, this is weird. And they said, oh my God, stay right there. Don't touch a fucking thing. And they come down and they collect their little light bulb evidence. And it actually helps, which is sick. But I think it's because that he was like, hey, this seems weird, that they were like, okay, maybe you're not our guy.
Mm.
Detectives, again, they also tried to find John. They found John. They saw John. They crossed John off the list.
Yeah. Bye, John.
Yeah. But with forensics, they were also able to connect. They were also able to collect more evidence. So obviously they got the light bulb. They had some of that seminal fluid. They identified area that Laura's blood was found. So her blood was found on a few things in her apartment, including that glass bottle. And that was really it for what 1980s forensics could do. While running tests on what they were able to connect, they were pretty sure that from what they understood, Jeremy was not their guy, Daniel was not their guy, and John was crossed off the list pretty quickly.
Okay.
Now, granted, Jeremy and Daniel still stayed on the list for a little while because they were pretty sure, but they weren't able to like concretely cross them off.
Right.
But they were fairly certain.
And this is still in the 80s, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So now all they could do was just hurry up and wait and hope.
Mm-hmm.
But winter came and left, and spring came with no updates. The case was getting colder month by month, and the town got more restless as each day flew by. They saw an uptick in violent crime with assaults, Laura's murder, and a nearby violent crime within months. I think there was more breaking and entering than they had seen before, and also there were more aggravated assaults and rapes that they were seeing than ever before. Granted, it's New Hampshire. There's like 5 people in the whole state, from what I understand. And
yeah, right.
That being said, like, there was more crime than they'd ever seen, but there still wasn't a ton of crime.
Right, but per capita, it probably felt like a lot.
Right. And so it's just kind of, yeah. Yeah. So it was just scary for everybody. And now they're seeing these violent crimes. There's a murder of someone who's young and upcoming and beautiful and smart, and there's no leads on who did it.
Yeah, for seemingly no reason.
Right. And so Portsmouth was getting into their protection, like all of the citizens were. At one point, they joined like a neighborhood watch, and so they created sort of like a citizens police force where they'd walk around the city in pairs, like you'd sign up for a shift. And they would literally only have a whistle, but they'd walk around so that if they saw anything, they could whistle and it would alert a local police officer to come by. Which is very brave, in my opinion, but also just kind of a cute little image.
Yeah, like, so what is there supposed to be a cop with his windows down just like waiting for my right? number to be called, waiting, to waiting hear that for whistle? The whistle? It's like a bat signal. Like, what yeah. I don't know.
Listen.
Different time.
Also,
I appreciate the effort.
What do you think they talked about? Like their crushes or something? Like you got all night with someone in your neighborhood. You're like, so have you seen the Johnson's new porch? It's ugly as shit, right? Like what yeah. do you anyway.
I know.
So it's very sweet, but they're getting into it and they're all shocked and stressed and worried and things don't seem like they're getting better. And their trust in the police force to figure it out isn't getting better.
Yeah.
And then another year later, there was an alarmingly similar homicide.
Oh.
So this one there is not a lot of detail on because it's still technically an open case.
Oh.
But from what we know, 20-year-old Tammy Elizabeth Little lived in Portsmouth. She was also an aspiring model who also went to Portsmouth Beauty School.
Oh, that's just eerie.
Tammy was spunky and energetic and had like the cutest little look I've ever seen. Her little haircut, dude, in one of the photos on Portsmouth's like unsolved homicides page, she has like a mullet that's got like a side shave in it. I think it'd be so popular on TikTok today. She's so cute. But like exactly what you think of when you think of like a little energetic thing in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Also, like Laura, Tammy went to a lot of the clubs and the bars at night. She was pretty active out with her friends. And I believe she was also on the dating scene. But she was found in October of 1982 in her bathtub. Also horrifically murdered with blunt force trauma to the head.
Sounding pretty similar.
And she was sexually assaulted.
Sounds very similar.
And it was like nearly a year after. It was 13 months after. Mm. Not even. And so there were just too many similarities with Laura. Both lived almost exactly the same. Tammy was a few years younger, but she was only a few years younger. She probably knew Laura. They went to the same school. They were both aspiring models. And 3 years is not that big of an age gap for school.
No.
And then they were murdered in horrifically similar ways. Almost, I think, and granted, again, there is not a ton that's open about Tammy's case because it is still technically an open investigation, but it sounds like even the kind of violence, the MO was all the same. Like, it was just a lot. Unfortunately, the similarities didn't end there. Tammy's case, like Laura's, also went cold, very fast. But because there's little updates because the case is still open, we don't know a ton. But what we do know is that after this, almost every single update that happened in Laura's case also included Tammy's name.
Okay.
So while Tammy's case hasn't publicly released a lot of details that involve Laura, Laura's has mm-hmm. involved Tammy. And about 4 years later, they started to come up with another suspect that they thought might be their guy. There were two other murders that were an assault and a murder combined by a man from another city in New Hampshire, Manchester, but they initially ended up not being related. It was an entirely different MO. The guy was nowhere near Portsmouth. I don't even think he had a license. Like, so I don't think he was getting around very quickly, but that was sort of checked off their list. And that was exciting and disappointing because one more person that wasn't your guy, you found another person that wasn't your guy, but he wasn't your guy.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was another special series that came out in the Boston Globe in 1996 that looked at a connection between Laura and Tammy. And at that point, everyone was like, okay, they lived the exact same life, pretty much.
A few years apart.
In the exact same place. They died in almost the exact same way.
On almost the same exact time of year.
Yep. So at that point, everyone was like, yeah, we know. Thank you. What's next? The lead detective on the case, Detective Mortimer, was retired at this point, but he said he knew the guy. There was an interview where he was like, I'm pretty sure I know who did it. And of course he couldn't say anything because they didn't have enough to arrest him or they would have arrested him.
Yeah.
But the suspect was apparently very familiar with Detective Mortimer. I mean, like, in and out of the police department, but also, and I don't know if you guys know this, but when you're in sort of like a small town, law enforcement and repeat offenders often get pretty familiar with each other.
Yes.
Yes. So you might be going to the store and see someone that you see at work a lot in a not great capacity, just hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of have to coexist with your work role and your in real life role. And sometimes, and I would say most of the time, it makes it almost more of a friendly relationship at work. Because you're like, hey, man, I saw you the other day. I hope you're doing okay. You can't keep doing this shit.
Mm-hmm.
But I hope you're doing okay. And this seemed to sort of be the vibe that the two of them had, where at one point the suspect was like calling Detective Mortimer up just to talk. But then afterwards, he'd like put in some sort of harassment claim that the police wouldn't stop leaving him alone. And like, it just sounds like a man who's very unwell.
Yeah, and they'd probably be like, all right, listen, guy, you know, you gotta stop.
Yeah.
He could have been like a stage five clinger.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Mm.
Imagine getting arrested and then calling the guy up who arrested you to be like, so I'm just lonely. What are you doing?
And you got to know me pretty well when you took my prints. So I was just wondering if maybe you had time for coffee.
But whoever the suspect was, he also had a violent history and allegedly he had the strength to do it. So Detective Mortimer was pretty sure he knew who it was.
Well, I do imagine you'd have to have strength to put a box spring in a mattress over somebody because I don't know how big the mattresses were.
Yeah.
But like that's heavy. That's hard. Heavy.
Also, whatever the blunt force trauma is, you have to have enough force behind you to make it do something.
Yeah, and I'm assuming moving them. Like I'd assume that Tammy didn't die in the bathtub. I would assume that she was moved to. Maybe she died there. I don't know. But
that's my guess as well. It seems like it would be a lot to murder someone and tie them up and rape them in a bathtub.
Yeah, it just sounds like a lot. There's a lot of moving parts there. And a lot of that you have to have some physical strength for.
Yeah. So I'd agree. But technology was catching up and new forensics helped tremendously. In fact, every update that we have for this case after this point is because of a new technology invention, which is pretty cool. So Portsmouth sent out evidence from Laura's case to a forensics lab in Maryland called Cellmark Diagnostics. Cellmark Diagnostics created a partial male profile from these. So this is in 2002 and Maine State Police also analyzed and tested more of this evidence. And again, it's like all the same evidence, but they're just taking little pieces and sending them to different places.
Mm-hmm.
Between the partial profile they got from Cellmark Diagnostics and then the partial profiles they got from Maine State Police, they were able to create a general profile from the cigarette left at Laura's and one piece of evidence from Tammy, I believe. But while they couldn't prove it was the same person with forensics, what they did find was that they couldn't rule each other out.
Okay, so it wasn't definitely not the same.
Right.
It just wasn't definitely the same.
Correct. So it's kind of like, you know, there was nothing there that made them say, okay, this couldn't be the same person, which DNA-wise, there's a lot of ways that you can say this definitely couldn't be the same person.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like, haha, we got him. But it was like, okay, all right,
we're getting closer. Yeah, we're getting closer.
And that was almost just as good for cases that had no movement in 10 years at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And the profiles gave investigators momentum they didn't have before. They added this to a bunch of different databases that they could, hoping that somewhere they'd get a match or that they could definitely exclude more people. And comparing different various offenders, not quite across the country yet, because I don't think we had all of those databases up by 2002, but as many as they could. And they also released a profile in 2002 from the FBI that described the profile of this offender as disorganized, spontaneous, likely a white man in his 30s, and not for nothing, the FBI read this man for filth. For filth. They were like, he wouldn't be familiar with the victim, but he might have like seen them around. Like they wouldn't be friends or in any way. They think that he would have poor work performance. He'd have inconsistencies in his jobs. They said that he'd probably be like a night owl who'd be like out and wandering the city. And they were like, yeah, and he'd probably be dumb.
Well, his breath smells and his fucking shoes are ugly as shit. He's got
mustard stained sweatpants.
Like he's nasty.
I mean, they didn't call him dumb, but they did say he'd have low intelligence and, you know, 6 to 1, half a dozen to the other. So like,
yeah,
it's a lot. They also believed he would have been very interested in talking about the murders after they happened. They said that they thought his drinking or eating habits would have changed after. And then they were like, yeah, and he also probably lives with his parents.
Fucker.
Yeah. And then they offered a $20,000 reward for any information.
All right.
Which I assume is like information that leads to an arrest, but very interesting. So they basically call this man out. Then they're like, we'll give you money if you help us find him.
Okay.
So in this, the leads started coming.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike the years, the leads started coming, but they did stop coming. So one by one, each new lead was checked off and dismissed, which was exciting and disappointing all in the same breath. As DNA continued to progress, in the mid-2010s, more breakthroughs came. Forensic genetic genealogy came in roughly 2010 to 2015.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what this is?
Of course.
I know you know what this is. But do you, dear listener? So forensic genetic genealogy is basically when you get a genetic composition from your forensics and then you can use it with different genealogy sites and sort of get a better lead on who you might be talking about, various family members if there are matches. You should read everything you sign if you're sending your DNA somewhere kind of matches.
Put it this way, the Golden State Killer raped and murdered like for like 30 years.
Yep.
And then he just went dormant. He was like an elderly man.
He
just
retired.
Like bringing his fucking trash out like the rest of us.
Yeah.
And his like niece or like cousin's niece or something was like, I want to know the history of our family and send their DNA to 23andMe or whatever it was, Ancestry. And if you check that box, you're allowing that stuff to be submitted to databases where they run those numbers. And that's one of the issues with it, right? Is that like if I do it and I check that box, well, I'm checking it for me. I consent to it. But what about the hundreds of people that I'm now implicating as well?
Yep.
Who also, by definition, are agreeing to it because I did, because their DNA is related to mine.
Yep.
So like all of my future, like if my great grandkids want to commit a crime, fuck, they will.
Good you luck, know
what
babe.
I, you know yeah. what I'm saying? Like,
well, and that's the thing. So with this, in 2015, like a man in Phoenix, Arizona was caught for the murder of two women in their 90s. This is not really relevant to our case other than the detectives out in Portsmouth saw it and they said, okay, hold up. If they can do that, we can do that. So they called up the forensic scientist who was able to put that together for the man in Phoenix, Arizona, got the evidence and was like, okay, listen, I can do it, but I need a very specific type of DNA. And I don't know if you have it, but if you have it, I'll do it.
That's incredible.
So they basically, I don't know if they brought her out to New Hampshire or if they sent evidence to Phoenix, but basically they had to send what they had and just like hope and pray that it had the exact right kind of evidence that she needed.
Yeah.
And so basically, I don't know all the fancy words for it. I am not a scientist. I don't claim to be, but there is a specific kind of evidence that includes a Y chromosome from the man in their DNA. So if she had the specific evidence that would have that Y chromosome present, she could do it. Mm-hmm. And they were able to find it. And I think it was only on the cigarette butt.
I was going to say, isn't it saliva?
I assume.
Well, that's what we send, right?
We send a lot of different things a lot of places. But yeah.
But if we're doing genetic genealogy, we're sending saliva.
Yep. So they were able to find that, which is incredible. And from that, they were able to run it through, you know, a third party genetic genealogy website.
Not naming names.
Not naming names, not saying it was 23andMe or Ancestry or any of those that you definitely, if you participate in, have checked that box on.
Mm-hmm.
But they were able to find two people that had related DNA. And from that, they were able to find the biological parents of whoever provided the sample.
Ooh.
And those biological parents only had one shared child.
A son.
A son.
And his name was?
Little baby Ronnie James Lee.
Ronnie James Lee. He's got three first names.
I know. I don't trust it. I never do.
It's like Ricky Bobby, but worse.
Ricky Bobby Lee. No, Ronnie Bobby Lee. Ronnie James Lee was 21 and living in Portsmouth in 1981.
Mm.
And while the FBI profile that said he lived with his mama was right on,
mm-hmm.
they were wrong in that he was not a white male, but he was an African-American male.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very interesting. That was like the update that they got right before they sent it out for the full forensic genealogy profile that was made up.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just interesting. But
were the victims white?
Yes.
Okay.
That being said, Ronnie had an extensive criminal history that included violent crime. In 1987, he was arrested on sexual assault and burglary and was incarcerated for 3 years.
Oh, you mean the same exact offenses that happened in these cases?
Correct, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And while I wish I could tell you I knew more about Ronnie James Lee, he actually died in 2005 of a cocaine overdose. So it's very interesting to me. And detectives couldn't immediately shut the case because while there was this sort of forensic makeup, they weren't saying, like, you know, they couldn't go and interview him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like they have immediate grounds to say you were here this day, this time.
Right.
We know that your DNA was found there, but like we would need more. However, as time passed and they see that history, they also saw that he had a long history of not only breaking into homes and assaulting women, but also stealing their valuables, which was present in this case. And they were pretty damn sure, but they just weren't certain. And they couldn't like go and collect a piece of hair or his saliva to make sure that it matched what they thought it did. You know what right. I mean? Like right now, it's basically tangential of, we have this DNA that matches with your parents, but we don't have yours for a side-by-side comparison.
Right.
So they sort of are tracking this down. And this is in 2021, basically.
Okay, so 16 years after he died.
Yep. And so they're looking around, and they finally find that he did have an autopsy when he died. And I don't know if you know this, because I didn't know this, but apparently when you have an autopsy, they often will take a blood sample and keep it as like a DNA card, basically.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Interesting. So
apparently that was a really easy thing to do once they found the autopsy clinician who did Ronnie James Lee's autopsy. And they hit it side by side and it was like a 100% match. And they said, okay, case closed. We know who the hell did this.
Wow.
So in 2023, they came out, they marked this as a closed case, and Laura Kempton's murder was finally able to be put to rest. The attorney general held a conference where they called it a bittersweet finding, which is pretty fair.
Yep.
I think cases like this are so fascinating where it's so long, it's been so long, and I can imagine that friends and family members gave up hope a long time ago that anything would happen. And it's cool and very inspiring to me to see how sort of technology progresses and how we can find closure for old wounds like that.
Well, not only that technology progressed, but that there were still enough boots on the ground to be doing the work to try to solve this. Like, with all of that comes more cases that need to be followed up on, and, you know, everything that's current, that it can be really hard to justify to some of these police departments with very finite resources that this is where they should be spending that money or these efforts on, you know, a 45-year-old case. Which, do I agree with that? No, I'd like them all solved.
I think that would be ideal, but it's understandable. You only ever have so much time, so many hands, and so much money in the pot, if you will.
But I'm impressed that they continued with it. I hope that her family was still around to hear that closure.
Her family was around, but they were not present at the conference. They actually had a victim witness advocate go and speak on their behalf, which...
I understand.
Yeah, absolutely. And they had a very nice message that they had her pass along. So I think that was definitely a very beautiful piece of closure for their family. But understandably, it opens up some old wounds.
Of course.
That being said, while we have on record that the person who took Laura Kempton's life is likely related to the person that took Tammy Little's, we have not yet closed Tammy Little's case. So that is still an open investigation. I'm assuming, I'm hoping, I'm praying that in a very similar way to how it took a few years from confirming Ronnie's DNA and actually closing the case and having him sort of maybe retroactively charged with it. I don't know. Essentially closing the case with him as their offender. I'm hoping the same thing is happening for Tammy Little, and that this period of waiting after the closure of Laura Kempton's is really just confirming and doing their due diligence, and that that's on the horizon. However, it is still open. So I did just want to say, if you know anything, have any information, remember anything weird that you think could help, it probably would help. Just go ahead and give the cold case unit a call for Tammy Little's investigation. You can call 603-223-6270. Please, please, if you have anything, I mean, I hope that we have it solved, but if we don't, this case is nothing if not an amazing example of how diligence over time solves a lot of these cases. Again, that is the cold case unit at 603-223-6270. But that is the Beauty School murders.
I'm so glad that there's finally an answer, like a resolution to Laura's, and I hope that it happens for Tammy's. It seems I wouldn't be surprised if maybe by 2030 we had the advancements needed to be able to do that. I hope that it's continuing to like advance in the way that it has been.
Yeah.
But with each of these cases trying to take something that we can learn, it's like we know so little about how it happened.
Yeah.
So that I feel like I think we can learn from sort of the people that were in the orbit of them. So like Daniel, if you...
Yeah.
Now, I don't blame him, of course, for any of that. But thinking hindsight's 2020, if you see something, just make the call. Just make the call. It costs you nothing. If you want to do it anonymously, you can. You had a better shot doing it back then with payphones.
True.
You know, and same with the man that was in the stairwell, essentially hearing something and then hearing it again, that if it sounded like there was a domestic going on, which it did when you could hear things kind of being thrown, it's like, just call.
You never
know. Because if it's nothing, sure, it's nothing, but let the police determine that.
Right. And you can also then have some peace of mind knowing someone is checking it out, and that if it is something, someone's on it. And if it's nothing, they'll never know it's you. You're not going to get blamed for it. And somebody who's prepared and able to help is there.
And 99% of the time, it probably is nothing.
Yeah.
But to me, that 1% of it possibly being something is worth me calling on the 99%.
Right. Well, and I also think that this is a really important case because it really highlights how an... You know, I hate to say it, but like how mundane a lot of cold case investigations go. It's like you get everything you can get and then there's nothing.
Then you just have to wait.
Most cold cases aren't a JonBenet. It's not like there's this possibility and this lead and this lead and that lead and this lead and this question and that question. It's just like, here's the 10 pieces of evidence and the 10 facts that we have. That's it. And then it's like a hope and a prayer that everything you collected is something that can one day be tied back to someone else.
Well, at the same time, you also gather all of that, gather everything you can, try to keep it as neat as you can, and then you tie it all up and make it look all nice, put it in a box, and put it away.
Yeah.
Because you can't do anything else with it, and 10 other cases just came up.
Yeah.
So you have to almost walk away from it, leaving it, like, right where you left off, so that if not you, whoever has to return to it,
right,
can pick up where you left off and do that. And it's just like, it's a hurry up and wait game. And I can't imagine what that's like for the family, to just have no answers, to have your daughter ripped from you for no reason.
Yeah.
There one night, gone the next. It makes no sense. And to not be able to see the person responsible.
Right.
Have to, at the very least, be alive to know that their name, like, it has been announced. You know, you are caught, and have them serve time, but to know, like, that is your reputation. That's where it went down. Like,
right.
You committed the ultimate crime. And you got caught. And I so wish that he had been.
Yeah. And I, you know, personally, I would have loved to see a little bit of justice on his end. And I think, you know, once again, this is just another example of, we are a criminal justice driven society. I don't know how you are, in practicality, a victim justice society, but there's not a lot of justice for them. We have closure.
Yeah, well, we didn't
know. But we don't have much more.
We didn't know what we didn't know. And I mean, he could have still been alive, but he died of an over. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. He died from other causes, but it's not like this was 300 years later. It's not like Jack the Ripper.
Right.
Where we're just now putting pieces together, you know, where we, obviously he's not around, but like, at this case, he had a chance.
Right. And I will say, again, it's not like they did anything wrong. It's not like the investigative work here was bad. In fact, it was phenomenal. They preserved a lot of evidence for a long time to a high enough quality that multiple people could run it, find more and more pieces to create a profile out of, and then connect it genetically back to someone else. Like, that's impressive. It's like every other update in this case. It's exciting and it's disappointing all in the same breath.
Yep.
And it's heart-wrenching. And so, again, if you do know anything about Tammy Little's murder, you can call the cold case unit at 603-223-6270. We'll have that in the show notes. We'll also have that on our Instagram for you. But just, I don't know. Man, this one hits home. These girls are girls that are relatable in so many different ways and had so much of a future. And all I can say is that I hope their families are doing well, and that at least there is some progress and some closure where there can be. If you wanted to see the people, the places, the things that we talked about in this episode, you can always do that at our Instagram, which you would find below in our link tree, where you'd also find our email, where you could send in case recs, pictures of your pod pets, a fun anecdote, your favorite hairstyle from the 80s. You could also find our Venmo, our PayPal, if you wanted to contribute to the pod financially, or you could find our little merch at Redbubble, which I think is cute. And we have some cute little designs being sent our way, which I'm very excited about.
Mm.
Just dropping that there.
More on that later.
So if you wanted to take a look at any of that in the next week, I heavily recommend it. And if I do look at my clock, that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.
Bye.